Hello and welcome to episode 4 of the Big COC podcast. I'm here today with a wonderful panel. We have Wayne Gooding. Hello, Wayne. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thank you, John.
He's, of course, the editor of Opera Canada Magazine, and he's a member of the COC Speakers Bureau and seasoned opera traveler, as we always say. And I just wanted to ask, when's the next Opera Canada coming out, the newest issue?
The newest issue, which is the fall issue, is at the printers, even as we speak. So I expect to have it out by around the 10th of October.
Wonderful. Well, I think our listeners should look forward to that. And you can pick it up at the Opera Shop, among other places around town. We also have back with us, after a little bit of an absence, but great to have him back, is John Jilks. He's an e-health strategist, rugby referee, longtime follower of all things operatic, and you can find his very interesting opinions on all things opera at his blog, operaramblings.wordpress.com. And also back is the lovely Jana Wichlow, who's joining us again. She is the Senior Communications Manager, Creative, here at the COC. And well-known to listeners as the voice of CFC on the some of the radio ads in the past.
It used to be.
and, of course, from the podcast we've been doing over the last few years. And my name is Gianmarco Segato, the Adult Programs Manager here at the COC. It's an exciting time. We've been sort of buzzing with conversation already pre-show about the two shows that have just opened this fall, Trovatore and Die Fledermaus, which opened last night. They've both opened since our last podcast. So I just wanted to go through again, just very quickly, how you can listen to the podcast. It's very important to us that people are listening. The easiest way is to go to our website, coc.ca, and click on COC Radio. It's a tab on the upper right on the homepage, and that will take you to COC Radio, of course, and there you can navigate to the podcasts. Another way is to, and I looked this up because I'm like, okay, how do you figure this out on our homepage is amazing, but it has a lot of stuff. So you go to the bottom. This is if you want to listen to the podcast directly and download them directly. You go to the bottom. There's a title that says Blogs and Podcasts, and you click on that, and then you click on COC Podcasts. It takes you to the podcast page, where you can download from there. And, of course, iTunes. That's a way most people, I think, are listening to podcasts these days. So I thought today we would start with our regular In the News section. And there was a story in the Globe and Mail quite recently, and this is, of course, relating to one of our shows this fall, is Trovatore. Robert Evergreen wrote an article called Il Trovatore Has an Ugly Resonance Against a Backdrop of Roma Persecution. And, of course, Trovatore, part of the story, involves a gypsy, Azucena, and she certainly is not liked by the society in the opera. And, I mean, with everything going on now and opinions about the Roma and what's happening to them across the world, but especially in Europe, a certain amount of persecution. I thought it might be interesting just to chat about this for a minute or so. Just how do opera companies and people putting on plays handle this sort of somewhat volatile, I guess, subject matter, you could say, these days?
Well, it's a tough one in a sense. It's interesting. When you alerted us to that we were going to talk about this, I missed the article, so I had to go back and find it. And it surprised me somewhat to see it here, this thing. I don't think anyone's going to go to a bel canto opera and expect it to sort of be full of steamy social significance when it's put on the stage these days. I mean, and so I think there's a bit of a fallacy in this article in the sense that it's taking a very real issue from our own times and projecting it backwards onto something from the 1850s, actually from the 1830s, if you go back to the original play. I mean, gypsy figures have figured in literature and music forever, and they are indeed a staple of opera, because one of the most popular, I mean, Trovatore is pretty popular, but one of the most popular operas is Carmen, and that has a sort of stereotype of a gypsy as a freewheeling spirit, someone who, you know, is maybe less restrained than we want to be, and so an enjoyable figure. But it's not she's not a dark figure in the way that Azucena is. There's no burning at the stake or anything like that. She's just an outsider. And I think that's to a degree how Verdi treats Azucena. He doesn't really paint a picture of a gypsy, or it's really someone who is an outsider. And so, yes, she, to the other people in the opera, she is a figure, they distrust her. And then there's the backstory, of course, which links her and her mother to Azucena. So I think this article is kind of overdoing something here in trying to say that current affairs give a particularly bad resonance to Trovatore. I think it's stretching things.
Well, I think what I wondered when I read the article is just, I mean, how far do we go maybe not putting on works like Trovatore, or Jen and I talked about this the other day, Merchant of Venice with its portrayal of Shylock.
Yes,
I mean,
exactly.
We could go on and on with of works of these
Othello.
Types. And what, I mean, it's an interesting point, but I mean, do we not put these on stage now, or do we have to have a disclaimer in the program saying?
I don't know why. I mean, the one that bothers me more than anything else in terms of operas that are problematic is actually Madame Butterfly.
Mm-hmm.
Because,
yeah.
Pinkerton is often represented as a cad who mistreats a woman. I mean, like has an assignation with a woman and then just dumps her and marries somebody else. It's much worse than that, actually. This is sexual exploitation of a minor. This is sexual tourism in Asia. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's a very real and problematic issue now. And that's never, thought of in terms of Madame Butterfly, but it's explicit in the score. She's a girl of around 15. Mm-hmm. So I'm much more bothered by that or how to deal with that than I am with something as artificial as a Trovatore story.
I think Puccini is guilty all over the place that sort of scene. I mean, Fanciulla, it's just appalling the way it's usually produced. I mean, with caricatured Native Americans going around mm-hmm. drinking the dregs mm-hmm. out of whiskey glasses and mm-hmm. caricatured Chinamen, and it's just and no earthly justification for it. I mean, I can see using a gypsy as a symbol of the other, or the racial politics in Othello being the racial politics of the time. I mean, that's legit, but I mean, Puccini is just so gratuitous, yeah. I find it very, very hard to justify at all.
Well, I understand Wayne's point a lot. I know people who will not go see Butterfly for that reason, that just can't stand that aspect of it, and Don Giovanni as well. I know someone who will not, just because of the way the women are treated,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
it's just...
Yeah, well, actually, when I read the Globe article, that's something that struck me, actually. Now, you raised that, Don Giovanni, is that, like, why pick upon the Azucena aspect? Because if you take Di Luna, he is actually, there's no rape in it, let's not go that far. But on the other hand, he is going to abduct her, and there's only reason why one reason he's going to abduct her. They're not going to live happily ever after if that had gone through. I mean, so, it's sexual violence against women. I mean, it is in there as well.
Mm-hmm.
But if we start to get so politically correct, I mean, if we start applying issues from today to all the operas, I mean, and saying, well, no, we can't really stage this because of that, or we have to have a disclaimer before we put it in, I mean, we won't be performing anything.
Well, you wouldn't be putting on Magic Flute, because when I see the lines, those sort of misogynistic lines about... It curls my hair.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
But it's Magic Flute. Yeah. I love Magic Flute.
Yeah.
If you're looking for political correctness and sensitivity, a lot of great art isn't where you're going to find it.
No, I mean, you've got another opera coming up this season, which would be right off the stage, and that's Salome, another young girl who's in a very dysfunctional family.
Yeah.
Necrophilia.
It's all there.
Stuff.
This is why we love opera. Wayne is going to give us a bit of a report today. This is our Opera Canada segment, and we kind of alluded to this the last episode, but what kind of, in looking across Canada for this upcoming opera season, what are some of the highlights that you've been able to discover, or interesting operas people are putting on, I don't know, interesting casting, that sort of thing?
Well, let's just talk about the operas to begin with here. It is actually a very interesting season because it's been skewed a little bit. At Opera Canada, we do publish the listings of who's doing what and where, and we actually have a master list which covers the whole season. So I was looking at this, and as you, all the listeners I'm sure know, and next year is the big double birthday bash for two of the most important names in opera, and that's Giuseppe Verdi and Richard Wagner, and we're celebrating the 200th anniversary of their birth. So the first thing that skewed, to my mind anyway, the thing that skewed the season now is Verdi, because if you look at what the companies are doing, there are 13 Verdi productions this season, which is very high, and two companies, that's Calgary Opera and Manitoba Opera, are actually devoting their whole seasons to Verdi. Now, Calgary does three main stage productions and Manitoba two, but nonetheless, that helps.
Well, when you consider how few operas some of these smaller companies do. Yeah, that is a really high percentage.
It's 100% in their case. Right. So what is this? Well, these 13, I mean, it's kind of interesting to see. There's a Macbeth in Victoria, a Trovatore here in Toronto, which the COC has now. The final two, both Otello and Falstaff in Calgary. Then there are two Aidas, one in Edmonton and one in Winnipeg, at Edmonton Opera and Manitoba Opera. Two Rigolettos, Opera Hamilton, just around the lake here, and Winnipeg, and five, count them, five Traviatas.
Oh, wow. You do the Traviata
there
tour.
There are five. It's not so surprising because Opera America, the service organization for the opera companies in North America, because the Canadians are part of this as well, Canadian companies, they publish a list of the most performed operas every year. And the top Verdi every time is La Traviata. It's in the top five. And the same is true of European statistics as well. Traviata is it. But five of them in Canada seems rather a lot. There's one in Calgary. And here's the interesting thing to me, though, is like Montreal opened its season a few weeks ago with a Traviata. And guess what? You just have to go up the St. Lawrence a little bit. And then Opéra de Québec in Quebec City is opening its season in a week or so with La Traviata. There's a small company here in Metropolitan Toronto, Opera York, which is doing a Traviata. And so we're going to be Traviata'd out. So Verdi really is, when you think of the number of companies, Verdi is dominating this time. Wagner, of course, is not getting such a look in here, and this is, I think, it's mainly a question of economics. It's just too expensive to put on. Here at the COC, luckily, getting Tristan, really excited by that. It's my favorite opera in the whole world. And this one is a production by Peter Sellers and with video artist Bill Viola. It's much traveled, but there are actually two versions of it. There's one which is almost like a concert version in which the videos go on at the back. And then there's a more fully staged version, and that's the one we're getting here. And so I'm very excited to see that. And the only other Wagner this season is up in Montreal in November, which is COC Connection. It's the Flying Dutchman in the COC's production. I think there's a segment on this show.
Yes, about we're talking about that in a second.
I won't go anymore. So bear in mind that this is only the season, this season only gets us halfway through the anniversary year, so I'm sure there'll be more Verdi to come, if not any more Wagner, in the 2013-14 season when we hear about it. But it's also interesting, if you look at it, it skewed things in such a way that some of the things that you expect to see in seasons don't exist. There's very little Puccini in Canada this year. In fact, there's none in the COC, and I can't remember when that last happened, actually. But there are two Bohèmes and one Tosca in Canada. That's your only chance if you're a Puccini lover. The Bohème in Ottawa and Vancouver, and a Tosca in Victoria. There's not much Mozart either, because Mozart's a staple. There's a Tito here with the COC, and then there are two Zauberflöters. Opera Atelier is reviving its Zauberflöter here in Toronto. And then a very interesting one, a much acclaimed Native American, West Coast Native American production done by Vancouver Opera is being revived as well. The other thing that's noticeable is there aren't many new operas on the schedules this year. Again, it's because of the skewing. I mean, let's just call it 21st century. Drauss's Salome is coming up at the COC, so we'll count that one in there as well.
It's
20th century, so let's go with it. I mean, it was important in its influence as well. But then apart from that, what is there? Well, there's the Poulenc Carmelite here at the COC. Jake Heggie's Dead Men Walking is being done in Montreal, which is a very
interesting to see that in Montreal. American. You know,
it is such an American. It's not a Canadian premiere because Calgary Opera has already done it, but it is going to be interesting to see it there. It's done extremely well in the U.S. Mm-hmm. I mean, the opera has been revived a number of times, so it will be good to see.
There's even recordings of it already.
Yeah, so that's good to see. Britain's Albert Herring is about the only English opera I can find actually out in Victoria. And perhaps one of the most intriguing, the most recent, and perhaps because it's unknown, it is most intriguing, is in Vancouver again, and that's Tea, A Mirror of the Soul by Tan Dunn. It's a 2002 opera, which is, he helped write the libretto. It's about a Japanese monk and a Chinese princess, and it deals with life, death, the circle of life, the tea ceremony, as you might imagine, is part of it as well. It's a full-length opera. It's a two-hour opera. So
this has been done before elsewhere?
It's been done in the U.S. where it was premiered. Mm-hmm. It's been done in Europe, but this is the first time. It's certainly a Canadian premiere. Wow. It's been done in Vancouver. In fact, there's a big opera meeting in Vancouver next year of Opera America. All the American companies will be represented there, and it's being done at that time, so it'll be good. And then the only other new opera is new Canadian opera is, and we talked about these before, and that's in Edmonton, where they're trying to do Edmonton is sort of under new management, Edmonton Opera, and they're trying to make links with Canadian companies, other Canadian companies, and two Toronto companies, actually, Queen of Pudding's Music Theatre and Tapestry New Opera, are going out there and mounting their own works as part of the Edmonton season, separate items.
Yeah, and well, we'll be talking with the general director of Edmonton Opera in a couple weeks about that.
So, yeah, so we'll it's going to be very exciting. Yeah, yeah, it's a very exciting
Wayne,
venture.
Isn't 2013 the Britain centenary as well?
It would be, yes. So that one's...
What happened to that?
Well, I'll yes, but listen, you know, 2012 is a Massenet centenary as well. He died in 1912, and you know how much Massenet has there been around.
Yeah, so, Britain's a more significant figure.
I think
in the
actually,
I'd argue with that. Yeah.
I'm not. I'm only talking here about main stage productions, and there are. We also keep track of some, you know, of recitals and this kind of thing. We don't publish them all, but there are actually quite a few Britain recitals around.
Well, here in Toronto, the Albert Connection is doing a big
Britain
festival. Britain festival. That's more song.
Yeah.
But I think they're doing the Canticles, which is sort of dramatic.
Exactly. Anyway, so it's an oddball season in that respect. I mean, the rest is all bits and pieces. There's a little Russian here, a little, French there and so on, but nothing outstanding. The one I have to say that I'm very intrigued about is Opera Atelier is doing Weber's Der Freischütz. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of, it's coming up in a few weeks, and it's kind of interesting to me because here we have a period instrument orchestra, Tafel Music Orchestra, doing a romantic opera. I know it's obviously not something that you see here for a while. And I think that that will, given their approach to operas and the fact that they've only done classical operas today, that company, that it'll be very interesting to see what they make up out of Freischütz.
It's a great move because, I mean, a lot of people will be curious to see how they do it.
As long as they don't turn it into a comedy.
Well, I hope not. The thing that's intriguing me, to be honest, is the advance. If you look at the advanced discussion of it, or look at the cast list and so on, it's kind of like it has the ballet is in it, and I'm trying to think where in Freischütz there is
Wolf's
a ballet.
Wolf's Glen scene.
Castanets in Wolf's Glen will be really something.
We'll see. It is an interesting departure for them.
Well, certainly, in the world of recording, and I think, you know, maybe in Europe more, the early music or period instrument movement has been encroaching more and more on the 19th century for quite a long time. It's just that in Toronto we haven't really experience that live, I think, so much anyway. Perhaps with Tafel.
No, it will be good. So, I mean, a few years ago, I mean, this is not in performance. I mean, there was a few recordings that came out that played Verdi of this period, and even early Wagner on period instruments, and tried to sort of do it in a slight, you know, not with the big 19th century noise we're used to, and the big modern orchestra. So, and it does create a different soundscape, so I'm looking forward to hearing
John Elliott Gardner did a fair amount of Berlioz as well.
Mm-hmm. That's right, yeah. So there is a lot of interest in that.
Well, it sounds like some sort of intriguing, unusual things in the season upcoming.
Yeah, especially if you like Traviata.
Yeah.
But it's really nice to hear you sum it all up because you realize how much good stuff there is happening.
Oh, it's an enormous amount.
Vancouver and Edmonton doing what they're doing. It's really exciting. Wherever you live in the country, there's something to go and see.
Mm-hmm. Oh, there is. There is indeed. And I haven't covered everything here. I mean, as I say, there are bits and pieces or one-offs of Pearl Fishers here, Comte Doffman and all that and so on. Yeah, well, we are very well served.
So Wayne touched on this, but what's coming up next in the podcast is an interview I recently did with Toronto director Marilyn Grunstall. Mare is going to be mounting what has really become almost an iconic production for the COC of The Flying Dutchman. at the Montreal Opera, Opéra de Montréal, this coming November from the 10th to the 17th. And I chatted with her. It's a Christopher Alden production, but she'll be remounting there. And we chatted recently about the challenges of putting on one production in a different city at a different company.
Okay, Marilyn, I'm curious to know, were you involved with this production of The Flying Dutchman in the past when we've had it here in Toronto?
Yes, I was actually the AD on both times we did it. First of all, in 2000 for the original production,
right,
and then again in 2010.
And just for listeners that wonder, what does AD stand for?
Oh, yes, sorry. Assistant director.
Right. So as assistant director, just maybe in a nutshell, what would the responsibilities have been?
Well, when you're an assistant director, I would say mainly the responsibilities are to be flexible within the needs of each individual director.
Right.
So your tasks will vary according to what the director requires. And the other thing, too, is that sometimes you are a connection between the company and the director, so that there's sort of a through line. So, you know, a connection between the director and the company through you.
Right, right.
And sometimes, you know, sometimes you do a lot of staging. Sometimes you do a lot of, you know, discussing with the director. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they want to do that. Other times you're there and you do what they need.
Right. In terms of this particular production of Dutchman, did you ever have to take rehearsals by yourself, or was that something that was more left to the original director, Christopher Alden?
I think that I can't remember the second time, but I think that probably there were times when I might do a chorus rehearsal or something
right.
like that.
Right.
You know, so yeah, I believe there were times when I did some rehearsals.
Right.
But Christopher is very hands-on.
Uh-huh.
So he's the kind of person you really have to be very much in touch with him according to what's going on.
Right. Now, what's going to be happening, just to remind our listeners, that our production, The Flying Dutchman, which, as I've already said, has been put on here in Toronto twice before, is traveling to Montreal. Now, what is the actual process when you're remounting someone else's production, especially when it's at a different company? I'm just curious to know, what you'll be doing.
Well, I mean, the process is similar to if you remount a production, you know, at the COC.
Right.
The second time, third time around, you have a lot of knowns. You know what the set's going to be like. You know the costumes. You know the lighting. You know the musical cuts. You know the staging. So there's a lot that is already sort of front-end loaded
right,
into it.
Right.
You have, when you're doing a show like this, you have to respect the original production. But then you have singers that are coming in who have not done the piece. And so you have to respect their talents as well.
Now, what I'm also curious about, and I don't know, this is a sort of controversial sort of question in a way, but is there any room for you as somebody who's remounting a production that exists already to insert your own ideas at all? Or is it kind of, this is how it is, and this is how we're going to do it again?
No, I don't. No, actually, I would say that's one of the last things I ever think about
right.
is, can I insert my own ideas into it? Anytime it becomes a question of inserting any ideas into it is to find out what works best in the piece with the people you're working with.
Right.
You know, I don't go, oh, well, here's Dutchman. I wonder what new ideas I can put in. No, I don't think that way at all. It's more if, let's say, a certain part of the staging might, you know, somebody might have a question of it. You know, you have to talk about it mm-hmm. and find a way to accommodate both the blocking and the integrity of the production.
Right. So if, for instance, a particular singer, I remember this production very well. It's one of our best productions, I think. But, you know, there are moments when the Dutchman, you know, has to ascend very high. I mean, what if somebody wasn't comfortable with that? Would you accommodate that? Or is that something that, you know...
I think that there is very little in this production that would physically, at least physically, mm-hmm. not be possible for a singer.
Right, right. Interesting. Now, we're taking this production to Montreal. They're renting it from us. Have any accommodations had to be made with the set, do you think? Do you know about this yet?
Well, I don't think so, because Place des Arts is, I believe, a similar space to what the Hummingbird was.
Right.
And that, you know, it's a large, very large theater. And so because I haven't been to Montreal to see that, I am thinking that probably it will transfer quite well.
Mm-hmm. And just to wrap it up here, you've worked on this production a lot now. What excites you most about this production? I mean, what do you really enjoy about it?
I think what excites me about the production is that it's a really honest telling of the story and of the opera.
Mm.
I think it really, the conceptual ideas work so well with the narrative, and I feel it's just a smooth transition, and I feel really comfortable with how it has been staged.
Mm-hmm. It's certainly one of our most striking productions, and I can totally understand, you know, why another company would want to mount it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. It's a great show.
Well, thank you, Marilyn, very much for joining us today. It's been an interesting sort of look into the, you know, a side of the production that not many people maybe even know about. We really appreciate you joining us.
Oh, well, thank you very much for asking me, and thanks very much.
Yes. Well, good luck.
Thank you.
Okay, so now on to our roundtable discussion for the week, and something we keep skirting around and talking about surreptitiously in the last few podcasts, but I thought what we would talk about today is kind of a big topic, but this whole new thing that we have now to enjoy in the world of opera, which is the HD transmission, and of course the ones that are most prevalent and most in the public eye are the Met HD transmissions. I can't imagine anyone doesn't really know what they are, but Johnny, you go to a lot of them. What, yes. What are these? These so, things?
So what you get to do is go to a large cinema and watch on the screen with lots of other opera lovers a live transmission from the Met of one of their productions, as it happens. I think they're doing 12 this year.
Mm-hmm.
And there's pre-performance features, there's intermission features, you're backstage, you're seeing the set changes, usually have some great star of opera like Renée Fleming, unless she's on the stage, interviewing the singers as they come off, you know, their chest still heaving.
Sweat pouring out their brows.
Yeah, it's like an in-depth backstage kind of fun look at what's going on.
And these have been going, I think, for about six seasons now, or five or six.
Been going
for a little while. So I think it's a good time to actually look at it and the whole phenomenon and how it's affected live opera, our perceptions of opera. I mean, there's a lot we could go into, but personally, I've been going to them now pretty well from the start. At the beginning, I was very keen, and I went to all of them. And as time has gone on, I'm whittling it down to my four or five per season, because what I'm finding is we're very lucky here in Toronto to have so much live opera, and I realize people in other cities don't have that luxury, but I'm just finding this sort of disconnect. It's difficult for me to really enjoy seeing opera on the big screen, blasted on speakers where all the singers sort of sound the same and have the same vocal level of volume and voice production, and it's a mixed thing. I mean, it's good and bad. So that's just a personal reflection on.
I think you make a very good point about the actual product, and I think the actual product isn't talked about nearly enough. I've written about this on the blog, so anyone wants to go read an extensive essay on it, they can do that. But there's a basic problem here, that cinemas are not adapted for showing opera. They have sound systems that are designed for blowing up the end of the world in car chases, and they force them way past their capacity to reproduce music remotely faithfully. So what you get is a solid wall of noise and an amount of harmonic distortion that, personally, I find quite hard to take. Certainly, I can listen to much higher quality sound reproduction off a Blu-ray disc at home than I'll ever get from a Met HD broadcast in a cinema. And yet, there's this perception that because it's the Met, you know, you're getting the best of the best of the best, and that's what the best in opera is. And I think it's a very, very, very sad delusion.
Wow.
Okay. I'm a little bit more concerned about it. I mean, I have to say I'm a fan of it. I've been going to it since the beginning, and I do it, and I still try and go and see them all. And I do it because I'm going to see productions, no matter how they're presenting on screen, I mean, bearing in mind that the way they're presenting on screen is not the way you'll see them in the cinema, and that what you're hearing is not what you'll hear in the cinema.
On stage.
Yeah. On stage. You know, I'm nonetheless getting to see productions I wouldn't otherwise get to see.
Oh,
and that's an important factor here, and sometimes singers that I won't otherwise get to see, and that's an important factor. I don't disagree with most of what John has said here, actually. The sound is appalling. But the problem is that it doesn't have to remain appalling. I mean, I think the success of this has surprised Cineplexes, which is mainly the cinema we see it at here, mm-hmm. and probably other chains do it, has surprised Cineplex as much as it surprised the Met. This was a thing that Peter Gelb started when the Met was running into real problems filling seats in the theater, and it just became more successful than anyone thought it ever would. So the sound could be fixed, but at the same time, one of the things that worries me about it is, nonetheless, once the sound's fixed, even if it's not too loud, which it normally is, or someone does something to adjust it, it's still giving you an impression of singers that the wrong impression, in the sense that they will never sound like this. And this, I've mentioned this before, but I'm going to mention it again, and that is the Ring cycle, because I reviewed it, because I had to review it, I saw the whole thing in a couple of times at the Met itself. And I saw it in the cinema, and now it's just come out on DVD, and mm-hmm. so I'm listening to it at home as well. And I tell you, the sound is much better in the cinema. I mean, the singers sound better in the cinema, and even on my equipment at home, than they did in the Met itself. I mean, they're bigger, the voices are bigger, the visuals in it are different. I mean, you've got multiple perspectives and so on. I mean, it's the way the cameras are called. And so what worries me about this is the expectations that it can arise in people about what people should sound like or what operas should look like, especially if they're unlike, I mean, we are not normal in the sense that we actually see more live opera than most people have an opportunity to. And so it's the cinema may be, experience may be more important in smaller centers than it is in a large center like Toronto or even Montreal. So its expectation, I think, is wrong. I think it is giving a distorted view, but my impression watching audiences and seeing these cinemas sell out, you know, even as we're in this fifth, sixth year here, is that people are really enjoying it. I mean, they're not coming out going, oh, that was a terrible experience, the sound was too loud, and so on and so forth, en masse. They're coming out really enjoying it.
I think that's a fair comment. I would say don't expect any improvement in the sound, because I have talked to the management at the Scotiabank Theatre about this very issue, and been met with absolute blank incomprehension.
Yes.
Same here.
No, I've been to a couple of cinemas around where I mean, the sound is variable between cinemas as well.
Sure.
This is purely anecdotal, but I have a friend in Seattle who actually went on the warpath with his local cinema, and they actually did get to the point where they actually went in and sat with them and sort of tried to show them what needed to be done. And, you know, I have no idea what happened in the end. I mean, how much it improved it. But, I mean, it's possible. I mean, you're right. I mean, these things are built for, you know, blockbuster movies, not for Met broadcasts. But it, you know, it doesn't mean to say it's going to be that way all the time.
I think it's not just the opera broadcasts. I go and see all the National Theatre mm-hmm. live broadcasts. And when they did Cherry Orchard last spring, I actually sat with my fingers closing my ears, and it was still reverberating, and I asked twice for the sound to be turned down. It was actually ringing in my ears, and they wouldn't turn it down.
That's not even singing, I mean.
And I remember that when I saw Rheingold, that Richard Croft came out to take his bow, and he was booed,
yeah.
and I was totally thrown by this, and then went home. And I think actually when I came into work next,
yeah.
I was asking you about it. You told me that apparently his voice couldn't be heard.
Yeah, he was
a smaller voice,
yeah.
and so some people in the audience were booing him, but sitting in the cinema, he
you would
was
never
just
know that.
Blaring.
That's what we're talking about.
Yeah.
It levels out things to the degree
yeah.
that, you know,
it,
the
it,
lightest
it,
soprano
yeah.
and the biggest Wagnerian soprano seem to sound
they come
almost
out the
same,
way.
You know.
That's
and,
right. That's the problem.
You could argue with that that's a problem with all recordings, I mean, to a certain extent, I suppose. I mean, Cecilia Bartoli is an amazing singer, doesn't have the biggest voice, but on CD, if you crank it up, I mean,
yeah.
I don't know. Maybe it's a bit different, but
I really love going to the Met HD broadcasts. I don't go to all of them. I did one year, and I just found there were just way too many Saturday afternoons inside the cinema, and I wanted to be out and about doing things. But I love going to see the performances that, you know, that most intrigue me. The reason I go, though, is purely budgetary. If I had the money, I'd fly down to New York and see everything live. I just can't do that. Same with the National Theatre broadcasts. I would go, I'd fly over, but I'm not going to do that. It's just a great way to see more theatre and more opera, because there's lots of wonderful live stuff here. It's just, it's more of it. I personally would never let those broadcasts, either of theatre or opera, replace the live theatre and opera I see here, because it just can't be touched upon. I will be so more moved in a real theatre, a real opera house, just the way the music reverberates through me, than I can ever be in a cinema. It just isn't ever going to happen. My only real concern is how they film it.
Don't get me started.
You don't have the choice of saying, you know. But so often I want them to pull back. I want to see set.
Yeah.
And some people don't photograph as beautifully as other people. And, you know, I don't want to hear mutterings behind me because Natalie Dessay looks a little bit older than her lover does. She's a wonderful performer, and in the opera house she's perfection, and I don't need the camera zooming in tightly on her when she's hitting some high note that is absolutely breathtaking, but I don't think she needs that either. And you know, I remember at the beginning of Don Carlos, Roberto Lanier had something in his nose. You shouldn't be able to see this, and he is doing a fantastic job.
All you could focus on was that.
The video editing is really interesting. I remember watching a DVD extra thing of Peter Sellers editing the video version of his production of La Mort en Loin. And he was editing on a 15-inch monitor. And I think that's part of the problem. I reckon they probably have those size monitors too in the back of the truck when they're doing the HD broadcast.
Well, I think you're right. They do. I mean, there's a truck outside on Amsterdam Avenue.
What it looks like on a 15-inch screen isn't even remotely representative of what it looks like on a decent, you know, domestic TV screen these days, let alone what it looks like when The Sopranos' tonsils are 8 feet long.
Yeah,
you know?
I don't think these things are bothering people overall. I mean, I think there's, you raise a couple of things here. I mean, one is the economics of this. I mean, for whatever it is, $25 max with taxes, you can go to an opera performance, which you can't do live Well, you can, but not very often. You won't be sitting as close as you appear to be sitting in the cinema. No. That's number one. The second thing is, again, you know, where you will go, Jenna, of course, you get to see a lot of productions. But remember what I'm saying, you know, Manitoba Opera, for example, in Winnipeg, two productions a year. Mm-hmm. So if you're a real opera lover in Winnipeg, unless you're traveling outside of Winnipeg, and there is actually one other small company, but you've got two a year, and that's it. So the importance, the relative importance of the Met broadcast or whoever's it is, I think is that much greater.
Okay.
And therefore, and also, but then that whole audience is perhaps becoming, you know, much more, again, their expectations of what they really enjoy about opera, you know, which is a bigger sound and maybe a more in-your-face, literally, perspective on the production, is something that could potentially work against Manitoba Opera itself. And actually, that's a good example this year, because and if anyone could do a study, it would be very interesting, because both of the Verdi operas that Manitoba is doing are also on the Met's HD schedule this year as well.
This sort of brings us to a point, and maybe we could talk about this forever, and there are so many aspects to it, but we seem to be skirting around this idea of, I'm curious to know what you think about how these transmissions are perhaps affecting smaller companies or larger companies for that matter in terms of actual ticket sales. I mean, you're right. I think people that are at these transmissions love them. And I mean, you know, is it going to get to the point where they love them so much that they'll just replace the live experience for a lot of people?
We've been doing this, or trying to follow this a little bit. I mean, we keep trying to gather good data and find out that it's very hard to get. Everything at the moment is anecdotal pretty well.
Yes.
It's what no one's really sure. But even Peter Gelb went, there was a, I think it was last, about a year ago, he was asked about this in the new, by the New York Times in an interview, and he conceded that they knew that they were losing people who would go in, not people in New York so much,
right,
but audience that maybe come in from Boston mm-hmm. were no longer making that trip because right. they were perfectly happy to stay in the cinema. And I've heard from people who have sort of said, well, no, I mean, you know, living maybe Kingston or something like that, I don't, you know, have so much need to go to the COC. Now I can go to
get my opera fix.
I can get my opera fix in the cinema. There have been some studies done. There is one, Opera Lyra did a very informal study and of a couple of operas, and it was kind of inconclusive. This was like within year three. They were finding that it was mainly their own audience that was going, I mean, to the cinemas at that point. I mean, it didn't seem to be bringing in a new audience. As a young musicologist in Vancouver, did a whole PhD thesis on the what was happening in the Vancouver area he studied, and he his conclusion was that actually it does seem to be bringing in a younger audience, just based on what he saw there. but it also was taking in the established opera audience as well, mm-hmm. and that people were, you know, the economics was a major factor in this and the cost of it. So the research is all over the place, but at the moment there is, Opera America is actually doing a major study right now on the, trying to come to terms with this. With a couple of the Canadian companies are involved in it. I'm actually not sure which ones. And so maybe after 5 years there'll be a little bit more hard data, but there isn't at the moment.
What about the other options? You know, I mean, there's the multiple online streaming options mm-hmm. now from, you know, Bavarian State Opera,
that's right,
Blind
yeah.
Born, and so on. And then, you know, don't forget, there are actually, you know, DVDs and Blu-ray discs out there, which, you know, you can use to get your opera fix too. But I'm kind of interested by how big the online streaming phenomena is and whether that's going to grow or not. Because the Met being the Met, the hype's always around the Met, and it doesn't make it the reality.
It depends on the size of your screen as well.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, that's the trouble with streaming. Unless you've got the technology to stream it to something bigger than your computer, it's not a very satisfactory experience.
Yeah.
But that's increasingly doable.
I'm interested in what you say, Wayne, about the, you know, this demographic in Vancouver that, you know, this man said he saw a younger audience. Because I'm pretty sure that when I go to the opera, the Four Seasons Centre, I'm seeing percentage-wise more young people than I do when I go to the Met HD broadcasts.
Absolutely. Mm.
I don't think it's attracting a young audience in Toronto.
I honestly don't know. I mean, I know what you say. I mean, I know I've sat in one of the cinemas here in at the Scotiabank Cinema where I usually go, and it seems like I'm sitting with all of my friends or something. I mean, there are people I know who go to the opera, and I don't see a lot of, I mean, there aren't few, but there are, you know, maybe 10 screens around the city are doing it, and I'm not sure what's going on elsewhere. I mean, it's hard to tell. I mean, it would be nice to know. I mean, in a sense, it would be good if it were driving people. I mean, if it was interesting people, young people, in opera, and maybe hopefully then they will come, you know, want to move on and go to the theater as well. But I think it's a Pandora's box. I don't think, you know, we know where this is going yet, because as John says, I mean, the streaming from Munich and so on, I mean, they're really good productions, and it's, you know, the technology is not that difficult to set up, and it's increasingly less expensive to do it at home. And one of the things, it's taking time. I mean, Gianni, you talked about not wanting to spend, you know, all those Saturday afternoons inside the cinema. Well, you know, for opera, if you like opera but you're not a maven for opera, then just those Saturday afternoons may be all you want, and forget the other evenings. You'd rather do something else than go to the theater.
I'd be happy for it not to be live and for it to just be shown on the screen 5 hours later, so I could just go in the evening, have a nice evening out.
Yeah.
Well, entire Saturday afternoon.
You have that option.
When it's sunny
with
out.
I mean, they do.
Yeah, that's
they
right.
Do,
the repeats.
They do some repeats. Yes, they do.
There's something about seeing it, knowing that it's happening right then, though. I have to say that
yeah.
I.
That's true when they did Con Jodi and Juan Diego Flores had just flown in from the birth of his first child.
Right.
Yeah. That was exciting. Yeah. You know, practically holding the curtain.
Well, I would love for us to keep talking about this, and maybe we can come back to this topic some other time. What it shows, I think, is that we're in the midst of a lot of change in terms of how people get opera, be it live or streaming or in movie theaters, and we'll see where it all goes. So thank you very much, Jana, Wayne, and John, for joining us again today. Please continue to listen. Send us your comments via Twitter, Facebook. We're going to be announcing each new podcast with a blog post, and you can comment there as well. We just would love to have your feedback on what you think about these discussions and possible ideas for other topics in the future. My name is Gianmarco Sagato for the COC, and these podcasts are sponsored by DECA, the opera label.